Welcome, welcome, curious souls, to the Macabre Emporium, your sanctuary for the unusual, the mysterious, and the appalling.
Step through our cryptic doorway into a world where secrets whisper and enigmas come to life.
I'm David.
And I'm Sarah.
Together, we're your custodians of the macabre, guiding you through tales that defy the ordinary.
Discover the untold stories, from lesser-known cases of true crime to the bizarre events that captivate us.
Join us on a journey to the shadows where the mainstream fades and the extraordinary beckons.
So whether you seek the bizarre, the eerie, or the chillingly obscure,
you're in for a treat here at Macabre Emporium.
Welcome back to Macabre Emporium. This is episode 70.
And if this is your first time joining us from Twitch, me doing my guerrilla marketing on the internet, as it's called from others, welcome!
Welcome!
So, last week's episode was against, not having an episode last week was against our will. The universe said, we're going to send you a deer echo and you're not going to get shit done.
A deer echo?
Yeah, that's when thunderstorms basically bow out because of high speed winds and cause tornadoes. And
it did cause a tornado.
Oh, yeah, it did cause a tornado in our area. Luckily, it was only like an EF1 or F1 for those still using the old scale. Luckily, there was only property damages, zero injuries, zero deaths. So our area got very lucky. I'm sure there was areas that weren't. And it is unfortunate if that is the case. And the ghost, he's deciding to be a fucking terror here in the fucking shop office today and won't hold fucking still. What is with you today, guy? I don't know. Maybe he sent some more weird bad weather shit on the way, because remember in the Ship Cats episode, they talked about how cats can predict thunderstorms and all that good stuff. And because of the changes of the electromagnetic fields, I guess, if I remember right. That was so long ago, how they would start rubbing their whiskers constantly. But if you have ever had the opportunity to see videos or ever met Legosi, you know he's something quite special.
Yep.
But anyway, so this is going to be a David episode this week.
Yay, and David!
And I'm bringing some true crime, and holy crap, was this a
doozy.
That was a doozy. I barely got it finished, and then we lost our power before we could even get it recorded.
Yep.
So that's also part of why, because there was a lot going on with it. This is probably the largest number of pages for notes that I have, because there's a lot that goes on that I did not want to leave out, because, like, you know, we said in the beginning, no details left out, right? So before we get to that, we're going to do our On This Day for July 24th. American aviator Amelia Earhart was born in Atchison, Kansas in 1897. Earhart was the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean between May 20th and 21st in 1932, but was presumed dead when her and her co-pilot disappeared over the Pacific Ocean in 1937.
Did you just say she was born in 1932?
1897, and she flew across the Atlantic in 1932. Oh,
okay, I was like, wait a minute. That doesn't make sense. Okay, makes sense.
The film Saving Private Ryan was released in 1998, starring Tom Hanks and Matt Damon, and is directed by Steven Spielberg. Captain John Miller, played by Tom Hanks, takes his men behind enemy lines to find Private James Ryan, played by Matt Damon, whose three other brothers had been killed in combat. Surrounded by the brutal realities of war, while searching for Ryan, each man embarks upon a personal journey and discovers their own strength to triumph over the uncertain future with honor, decency, and courage. The film made $482.3 million at the box office. And I tried finding multiple inflation calculators and trying to boost that today. None of them would do anything over $10
million. Huh.
So, who knows? Could be double, triple, whatever that is now today. The song Careless Whispers is released as a single by George Michael, which is also credited to the band Wham in the United States in 1984, and would be Billboard's Song of the Year in 1985. In 2005, Lance Armstrong retires after he won the Tour de France, but later on, in 2012, would have this win struck from the records due to his doping scandals in 2012. I wasn't able to find anything technology-wise like I do every week for On This Day. But there is one invention that probably did help all those scientists and inventors stay awake, making their discoveries and breakthroughs, and that was instant coffee in the year 1938 invented on this day.
I'm like, what? No dose?
Yeah, not kind of, but not nearly as bad. In 1946, the U.S. performs an atmospheric nuclear test at Bikini Island, allowing the atomic fallout to let SpongeBob and his neighbors come to life.
Oh, God.
What?
Is this why you had asked me about Bikini Bottom?
No. Oh. That was something completely different. When, like, a couple weeks ago, I was Googling something else, and for some reason, I Googled, where is Bikini Bottoms located at? And I was like, holy shit, I cannot realize I just Googled something about SpongeBob for an episode. TV personality and one of Notre Dame's most well-known alumni, Regis Philbin dies at the age of 88 in Greenwich, Connecticut from a heart attack in the year 2020. That's our on this day for this week. So anything nice, fun and interesting things you want to talk about?
Nope.
Other than it's fair week going, we're in the middle of fair week here.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you looking forward to at the county fair if we go?
Nelson's.
Of course, I knew the Nelson's. Anything
that's
else?
That's about it.
That's it?
That's the only reason I care to go.
That's it?
Yeah.
All right. No mini donuts? No the ice cream from the dairy barn or anything else like
well,
that?
Well, yeah, those, but they're not the reason we go.
I know. It's just a long-standing tradition to go pay $10 for the both of us to go in there and to go eat Nelson's chicken.
And it's like the one date night a year we actually get.
And then also just wander the midway a little bit, kind of, and cruise all the commercial booths of people selling shit till we have our limit of being in a crowd. And one thing I'm surprised she didn't say.
What, the goats?
Seeing the baby goats at Old McDonald's farm.
That
all the baby animals.
Is a given.
They don't know that.
Baby goats.
I know that, but they didn't know
I like that. Walking through the horses.
Yeah.
The barn of horses.
Until she can't breathe because she has an allergy to them.
Yep. Can't go. Shouldn't be in there. Can't go in the rabbit barn.
Right.
But it's whatever. Fuck rabbits.
It's like, I love horses. I don't care if you guys Dana might kill me, but I love you, you tall, linky motherfuckers. Pretty much how it goes.
Pretty much.
I'm always like, are you good? Oh, I'm fine. No, you're not. Let's go. Gotta get you out of here.
Yeah.
But anyway. So this week for a true crime episode, I am doing a mass shooting. I know. Shocker that I'm doing a mass shooter of some sorts, right?
Yeah.
It's like if I had this conversation with people I work with that have asked about us, our podcast, and other people have asked about it. It's like, Sarah focuses more so on like serial killers when it comes to true crime. I do the more unique oddball stuff and mass shooters because I find them more interesting.
I haven't really done any serial killers. I've done like...
Well, serial murder, almost.
Maybe two or three.
Yeah. But I'm saying more of the single event type murders.
Yeah.
With like maybe one or two victims, and then I'm like doing the ones with multiples.
Yeah.
Because I just find it interesting to see their descent into madness for why they go and do these things, you know. But this one, it's really kind of weird because of his upbringing. It's like you never expect, you know, mass shooters to do these kind of things. But his early life, it's just like you never would have thought that. But it's not because any events like that, like all of them. But anyhow, you ready to get started on this?
Yep.
All right. Mark Essex was born on August 12th, 1949 in Emporia, Kansas. He was the second of five children in total. His parents, Mark Henry and Ellie Essex, raised him and his siblings in a close-knit religious household. His father worked as a foreman in a meatpacking plant, and his mother was a counselor for preschool-aged children with disadvantages growing up. He had numerous friends growing up in Emporia, a community of 19,000. It prided itself in a long tradition of racial harmony. He was a member of the Cub Scouts and played the saxophone in high school. He also enjoyed hunting and fishing in the area around Emporia, Kansas. He was never in trouble with the law except for one time he did get pulled over because an officer thought he was too young to drive due to him only being like 5 feet 4 inches tall.
He was a little dude.
Yeah, he was a little tiny guy. In high school, he was considered an average student but performed best in technical subjects like your shop class kind of things, and graduated in 1967. While in high school, he would tell his mother he did not see much difference in white or black girls he dated while he was in high school.
Back then, that was still kind
of... That was probably a big deal if outside of the town he lived in for, you know, interracial couples to be a thing. After he graduated, Essex enrolled at Emporia State University but dropped out after one semester and worked at the same meatpacking plant his father did while deciding on his next career move or attending school again. He enlisted in the Navy shortly after his 19th birthday and has felt his options were limited living in Emporia. He ended up enlisting in the Navy on January 13, 1969, after speaking to his father, a World War II veteran, advising him to enlist and seek training there. His family said he was happy-go-lucky as he prepared to enlist into the Navy. While he was in the Navy, he was assigned to the Naval Station in Imperial Beach, California. During his time there, the Naval Station was home to 7 helicopter squads. It also supported an aircraft maintenance training program and a fleet of airborne electronics training unit. After his basic training was finished, he would go on to apprentice as a dental technician in April of 1969, specializing in endodontics and periodontics.
That's quite the change up.
Yeah.
From the Navy to teeth.
Yeah, well, he's still enlisted in the Navy, but he's also, for those that may or may not know, endodontics encompasses the study or practice of the basic and clinical sciences of the normal dental pulp, the material inside of your teeth.
Okay.
The etiology diagnoses prevention and treatment of diseases and injuries of the dental pulp, along with associated periodontal conditions. Root canals are performed by those who specialize in this.
So that's what he did, was root canals? Mm-hmm. Okay.
And periodontology, I'm not even going to try and attempt to say that again, specializes in the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of periodontal disease, a chronic inflammatory disease that affects the gums and bones supporting the teeth, also known as gum disease, and in the placement of dental implants. So that's what he basically focused on, with dental implants and doing root canals and such. Basically, okay. Other basic dental hygiene things, being a technician. He would also form a close and ongoing friendship with his supervisor, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Hatcher, who was a white officer in the Navy. Essex would learn bigotry from many white servicemen towards the blacks, but it is either discreet or if it was either discreet or out in the open, and this was an everyday occurrence for blacks serving in the U.S. Navy at this time. He would also take on a job as a bartender at an enlisted men's club called the Jolly Roter. Here he would learn, which is a very fun play on words, being the Jolly Roter instead of the Jolly Roger, because, you know, this is a naval air base for helicopters.
Yeah.
Here he would learn that certain rooms were still off limits to blacks, even though desegregation ended in 1964. He would write a letter to his mother about his experiences of race relations in the Navy and didn't think this is how it would be in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
Throughout 1969, he was told by other black sailors that he would be treated better once he achieved a higher rank, but by the time he rose to the rank of seaman, the harassment continued, and he started taking sedatives to deal with the constant harassment. You failed me. I figured you would start giggling once I said seaman.
Yep. No.
Damn, Sarah's inner 12-year-old didn't come out like I was anticipating.
It didn't.
He would meet another sailor who worked in aircraft maintenance named Rodney Frank, and they would form a close friendship and spend a lot of time together off duty. Frank also encouraged Mark Essex to read literature about Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, the founders of the Black Panther Party. By August of 1970, Essex would get in an altercation with a white non-commissioned officer after hearing comments the NCO made about how beautiful it must have been in the past when I went to sea and was below decks in the galley. Yeah. Essex and his combatant agreed to a compromise to avoid each other and attempt to avoid any disciplinary action against either of them. However, since he did get in a fight with a higher rank, the harassment and intimidation he was experiencing would increase from white sailors. 2 months later in October, Mark Essex went AWOL from the Navy after calling his mother, "I'm coming home. I just got to have some time to think." In his absence without leave, Essex would return to Emporia on November 16, 1970. He would repeatedly tell his family about the blatant discrimination he experienced in the Navy from many white sailors, his bitterness, and his growing hatred towards white people. His family attempted to reason with him against his views, but he exclaimed, "What else is there? They take everything from you. Your dignity, your pride, what can you do but hate them?" A month later, he would finally be persuaded by his family to return to Imperial Beach. He spoke to Lieutenant Hatcher, his senior officer, when he was still practicing dental work in the Navy, before he went AWOL, and explained to him his reasoning for deserting the Navy. "I don't want to have anything more to do with the Navy. It wouldn't be fair, not to you or the dental patients. The bad atmosphere would affect my work. The work is the only thing on this base I like." he would agree to the charges of desertion from the military. So the difference between a desertion and the and going AWOL as they're basically almost the same up to like 30 days. AWOL is what we more commonly know due to this television and film, because they always goes, oh, he's gone AWOL. We gotta go get him back, you know. So AWOL is absent without official leave, but without the intent to desert. Service members can be considered AWOL for a minimum of 24 hours and up to 30 days before considered a deserter of the military. After 30 days, they are automatically counted as a deserter. Charges for being AWOL are being confined for a month, and which is confined to the base. They can't leave the base. So, and also the forfeiture of 2/3 pay for 1 month. Desertion charges may include a reduction to the lowest enlisted rank, forfeiture of all pay and allowances, and confinement for up to 2 years, up to life, depending on the severity of the desertion. During wartime, the death penalty could be punishment for desertion. Dishonorable discharges from the military comes with both of these charges and could make it difficult for employment and receive benefits outside in the civilian world. Why are you shaking your head about that?
Seems a little overkill.
Well, you do sign a contract when you do join the military.
To be put to death?
During wartime.
It still seems a little...
It all probably depends. Like, there is that one cemetery in France that I did in the Cemetery Origins episode that has...
The pauper's graves?
No, they're not really pauper's graves. They're just numbered graves with no names on them because they were deserters in the army and committing war crimes. And their stones are turned away from the U.S. flag because they turned their back on the United States.
Yeah.
During his court-martial, Lieutenant Hatcher testified in Essex's defense, praising his work ethic and stating that Essex's reasoning for desertion had been influenced by racial discrimination he was experiencing. The judge agreed Essex's reason was valid to desert the Navy and sentenced him to 30 days confinement to the base and forfeit $90 of his pay, which is now equaling $730 today in 2024.
Damn.
And he was also given a general discharge from the Navy for general unsuitability on February 11th, 1971, when he was 21. He became bitter towards whites because of the discrimination he experienced, and this led him to continue into the Black Panther ideology that was introduced to him by Rodney Frank. He would soon begin to refer to himself as Mata, which is the Swahili word for hunter's bow. Around April that same year, he would return home to Emporia, Kansas. He would end up purchasing a .44 caliber semi-auto Ruger carbine by mail from Montgomery Ward's. He began to take up target shooting out in the country, but with him growing up being outdoors and hunting, probably nobody really paid no attention to this figure, and he's just picking up old hobbies from when he was younger. But the fact that he mail-ordered a rifle, you can't really do that today.
No.
Especially from Montgomery Ward also, because they no longer exist.
Did they turn into just an online business? Are they gone?
I think they're gone permanently. Like where our Hobby Lobby is and whatnot, that's where it was here.
Huh.
That August, he left the family home without notifying his parents or any of his siblings and headed to Louisiana to be reunited with his friend Rodney Frank in New Orleans. He would end up moving 4 times before settling in the Central City neighborhood of New Orleans. In August of 1972, he enrolled in the Total Community Action Program and began classes for vending machine repair and rose to the top of his class. He also started an African studies class and memorized terms and dialects from Swahili and Zulu. Investigators would also find all these on the walls of his 2-bedroom apartment later on. That summer, he would also buy another firearm, a .38 caliber revolver, and he would then become more solitary while battling severe depression. In September, the New Orleans Police Department announces the Felony Action Squad to reduce the number of violent crimes in the city. They stated that if any members of the FAS are threatened, they are authorized to shoot to kill, and I'm sure the racial tensions of the South, and it still being in the early 70s, that this is probably just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
In itself. On November 16th, 1972, Leonard Brown and Denver Smith, who were both 20-year-old students at Southern University in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, were killed by sheriff deputies during a week-long campus demonstration for adequate services for Black students. These students wanted better food, funding for the school, and better housing. Even with the school's president and administration being Black, the university itself was still under the control of the state of Louisiana, and not nearly much funding from the state was being spent. This whole event, when I started looking into it, because it is very important to the knowing why Mark Isaacs did what he did, this whole event could be an episode of itself. The investigators believe that the killing of these students was finally what caused, is what finally caused for Mark Isaacs to feel it was time to take an act against police aggression towards blacks. He would end up writing a letter to his mother, and in his letter, it was very short. It was only a couple sentences, but "Africa, this is it, Mom. It's even bigger than you and I. Even bigger than God. I have now decided that the white man is my enemy. I will fight to gain my manhood or die trying. Love, Jimmy." Because his middle name was James and his mother called him Jimmy. That night on Christmas Day, the night of Christmas Day, I had a hell of a time trying to figure out how to word that out so it sounded correct. So Christmas Day at night.
Christmas night.
Yeah. Yes. I spent way too much time at my desk trying to figure out how to word that. And here she comes in here and just like, oh yeah, Christmas night. It's like, fuck. Fucking bullshit. But anyway.
Sorry.
It's fine. Christmas night, Mark Essex would spend his evening talking to each member of his family and show no signs of distress. The following days, he would give away a majority of his possessions to neighbors and other people he knew, telling them he was planning to move back to his hometown of Emporia, but he had no actual intentions of doing so.
He was going out in a blaze of glory, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess you could say.
Okay.
On December 30th, he would write a letter to WWLTV where he described his intentions to attack the New Orleans Police Department on New Year's Eve. He would also state in his letter that his impending attack was justified as vengeance for the death of the two innocent brothers in the SU civil rights demonstration in November. I tried to find what he would put in his letter. I could not find a copy of it anywhere. Around 10:55 p.m. on New Year's Eve, Mark Essex parks his car and starts walking down Piedro Street in New Orleans. And this is about a block away from the New Orleans Police Department, armed with his 44 caliber Ruger carbine and his 38 revolver, with a bag full of ammo, a gas mask, wire cutters, lighter fluid, matches, and a string of firecrackers.
He was fucking ready.
Yeah. I know it sounds like a whole bunch of oddball things, but yeah, it all makes sense soon. He would first start taking shots at officers from parked cars in a dimly lit parking lot at the Central Lockup in New Orleans, shooting at 19-year-old police officer Cadet Bruce Weatherford as he reported for his duty for that shift. Weatherford dove for cover behind a parked car and saw a 19-year-old Cadet Alfred Harrell run to his aid. Essex shot Harrell once through the chest and also wounded Lieutenant Horace Perez in this first initial attack. Perez was wounded in the ankle by the same shot that struck Harrell as it ricocheted off a wall. Harrell would be the only non-white victim in this attack due to the parking lot being dimly lit. Harrell was an African-American cadet for the New Orleans Police Department. Mark Essex fires a total of 6 shots in this first attack, and before jumping a chain-link fence and running across Interstate 10 while lighting firecrackers as a diversion to his location. Moving into the industrial area of the city, during his escape, he would attempt to gain entrance to a Burkhart manufacturing by shooting rounds from his carbine rifle at the door. It is unclear if he had the intention to or not to trip the burglar alarm, but officers Edwin Hollis Sr. and Harold Blabbert responded to the alarm unaware that this was connected to the attack at the Central Lockup. The two officers first circled the building in their patrol car looking for any signs of forced entry. Officer Hossel and Blabbert were also a canine unit, while Hossley was removing to get the German Shepherd from the backseat of their police cruiser at 11:13 p.m. Mark Essex shoots him in the back, and Officer Hossley would die months later on March 5th.
Damn.
Essex would fire several more rounds at the car, shattering the windshield. Officer Blabbert would call for backup and fire in the direction of Mark Essex's muzzle flashes were coming from, and then pulled his partner back into the car, waiting for backup. 30 more officers then showed up, as they would send in 2 canines to search for Essex, but he had already escaped. They would only find his 38 revolver, discarded live ammunition, some blood spots on the ground, and a bloody handprint on a windowsill. So he must have gotten hit at this point.
Yeah.
New Orleans Police Department conducted a house-to-house search for Essex, and they ended the search at 9 a.m. on New Year's Day, 1973, after 2 live rounds were found pointed at the doors of the new St. Mark Baptist Church, about 2 blocks away from the Burkhart building. The pastor of the church would find Mark Essex inside, but not aware of who he was and what he had done at this point. He fled the church seeing Mark Essex armed, and called the police at a neighboring house. Although Essex had escaped by the time they had arrived, the investigators did determine later that He would return here on January 3rd, but the day before, 33-year-old grocer Joseph Parnicio observed Essex with a bloody bandaged hand and sold him several items, including food and a razor. Suspicious that Essex was involved with something due to his hand being bandaged, he ordered his stock boy to follow him and saw Essex enter the church. Parnicio called the police about Essex's location, but once again, the police arrived when he was gone. They would find more 38 rounds hidden in the bathroom, along with a letter to the pastor breaking into the church. His movements between January 4th and January 6th were unknown, whereas investigators determined that he didn't return to his apartment during those days. On January 7th at 10:15 a.m., Mark Essex returned to Joe Parnicio's grocery and shouted at him, "You, come here!" But he would attempt to flee, and Essex would severely wound him with shots from his carbine rifle. They didn't specify how he was wounded exactly. They just, all my sources I used said he was just shot by Essex. Essex would carjack 38-year-old Marvin Albert's 68 Chevy Chevelle in front of Albert's home and tell him, "Hi, brother, get out of the car. I don't want to kill you, but I will kill you too." Ooh. Essex then drove downtown New Orleans to the Howard Johnson Hotel, which is now a Holiday Inn, which is located across the street from City Hall and New Orleans Parish Civil District Court. He would try to make entry attempts to the hotel by trying to find an unlocked door on the fire escape. And in the middle of him trying to find an unlocked door, he would encounter two black hotel maids and say, "Let me in, sisters, I've got something to do." They would refuse him entry, telling him it was against the hotel's policy. The pair had seen his rifle in his hands and would alert the management of this as he ran to the next floor trying to continue to find an unlocked door.
Huh.
He would actually finally find an unlocked door on the 18th floor of the hotel that was being propped open by a stack of linens. He would then again encounter three more black employees and tell one of them, "Don't worry, sister, we're only shooting whites today." These employees also would run and alert the authorities as well. Outside room 1829, 28-year-old Dr. Robert Stiegel would see Essex and ask him what he was doing. Essex would raise his carbine rifle, getting ready to shoot Stiegel, and he would lunge at Mark Essex in an attempt to get his rifle away from him. Stiegel ends up getting shot through the arm and fatally in the chest on the floor and shoots his wife, 25-year-old Elizabeth Stiegel, in the head while she pleads with him not to kill her or her husband.
Wow.
He would then set fire to the Stiegels' hotel room along with rooms on the 11th floor, and he shot and killed the assistant manager of the hotel, 62-year-old Frank Schneider, in the back while he tried to escape Essex after one of the maids warned him and a hotel porter about Mark Essex. Schneider came to the floor to investigate the employee's reports of an armed man in the hotel. The porter, Donald Roberts, escapes in a stairwell and calls the police. Mark Essex would then set a room on fire on the 10th floor and fatally shoot the hotel's general manager, Walton Collins, while he attempts to warn hotel guests about the fires. Collins would die later on January 26th. The police would finally arrive at 11 a.m. after the first shots are fired. And officers Michael Burrell and Robert Childress were the first to arrive at the hotel. After being informed by a maid, Beatrice Greenhouse, who also warned the same one that warned the assistant manager about Mark Essex, told the officers the gunman was on the upper floors in an error of using the elevator instead of the stairs, they would get stuck near the top floor due to the smoke and fire alarm stopping the elevators.
Oh, no.
So this lack of judgment, poor judgment call, I'm going to say, is actually basically what saved their lives initially. While the first two officers that could have possibly stopped all this are stuck in an elevator, Mark Essex shoots 43-year-old guest Robert Beamish in the stomach near the 8th floor swimming pool. Beamish falls into the hotel pool but was not fatally shot, and he escapes by waiting in the pool for 2 hours. At 11:20 a.m., New Orleans Fire Department and New Orleans Police are on scene of the fires and the shooting at the hotel. Hotel guests could be seen on hotel balconies trying to escape Mark Essex and the fires, but rescue attempts weren't possible due to Mark Essex taking shots at first responders. The incident command would also order marksmen on the perimeter and do a room-by-room search due to the conflicting descriptions of the shooter, causing them to believe there's more than one. So the incident command for all this, they had sharpshooters on all the rooftops.
Uh-huh.
There's a little fun thing about that comes into play later on.
Okay.
Just a more of a, like, fuck around, find out, bro, kind of thing. 29-year-old firefighter Timothy Urson and two New Orleans police officers would make an attempt to rescue those trapped, but Essex spots them and shoots Urson in the shoulder. Urson would survive but lose an arm due to being shot. Essex would then shoot 20-year-old ambulance driver Christopher Kent in the back while loading Timothy Urson into the ambulance. Patrolman Charles Arnold would be shot in the jaw by Essex from his position after opening a window. He was one of the sharpshooters. And he would walk himself to a nearby hospital and survive.
Damn.
Sheriff Deputy 33-year-old David Munch would also be wounded in the leg and neck while aiming for Essex on the 8th floor from across the street. At 11:55 a.m., Patrolman Kenneth Sullis and David Kahn are trying to get the crowds to disperse from the north of the hotel, and when Kenneth Sullis gets shot in the right shoulder, McCann would carry Sullis out of Essex's line of sight, and 43-year-old Officer Emmanuel Palomisano would be wounded in the arm and back trying to help to rescue Sullis. 26-year-old patrolman Philip Coleman would be killed and shot due to a shot to the head while trying to open the door of his patrol car to save Palomisano after he was shot.
Damn. That's a pretty large body count.
And so to think this has all happened so far in just an hour.
Mm-hmm.
By one man and one rifle. And I know I've covered other shooters that have done way more damage in a shorter amount of time.
Yeah.
But the firearms like James Hubert used weren't available, I don't think, to the public at this time yet.
Yeah, because that would have been later.
Mm-hmm. Because this is 1973.
Yeah.
And that happened in 1984. But I could be wrong about availability of fully automatic rifles at this time, but I highly don't think they were purchasable by the public at that point.
Huh.
Legally, at least.
Maybe.
Essex tries to escape back to his stolen car, where he shoots at and misses two more police officers and returns to the 16th floor after his encounter and sees 33-year-old officer Paul Persigo diverting onlookers. Persigo is hit in the mouth and staggers before hitting the sidewalk and is pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital. By noon, rescue parties were being formed by Louis Sergo to free the first two officers. Hearing the sounds would be like of a police whistle around the 16th floor, but they would continue to ascend the stairs. Sergo is shot at point-blank range in the chest. Essex would then go up to the hotel's roof. Sergo would be pronounced dead when he arrives at the hospital. When he got shot in this chest, some of the reports said that his spine separated from his body.
Oh, damn.
As he flew back.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Just to give you an idea how much damage that did at such a short range.
And then to be point blank on top of it.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
By 2 p.m., Essex is almost out of ammo, and the firecrackers he was using to draw attention away from him and retreats to the cubicle on top of the hotel where the stairwell ends into rooftop access. So over the next 7 hours, Mark Essex would hold up in this bunker-type part of the building and start taking shots at the police and a United States Marine Corps CH-46 Sea Knight helicopter.
He was shooting the helicopter? Yep.
So you're probably, what's the deal with this helicopter, right? So before I get into that, so one thing I told you about, the whole thing about the sharpshooters.
Yeah.
While he's in this siege with them on the top of the roof, he threw out an empty cigarette packet.
Uh-huh.
And one of the sharpshooters would shoot at it as a kind of a way of intimidation. As a, come on and fuck around and find out, bro, kind of deal.
Yeah.
And just they would just take shots at it, you know, just to make it dance around and be like, yeah, we're still here, guy. So, but let's get into this whole helicopter thing, because this man, I don't know how he found a helicopter, one, to fit his balls inside of the cockpit of this thing because of what he does. So, United States Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel Charles Pittman was watching everything unfold on the news, and so was the rest of the world in New Orleans.
Huh.
He was in command of the United States Marine Corps air units in Belle Chasse, Louisiana, south of New Orleans on the Mississippi River. He flew over 1,200 combat missions and was shot down 7 times while serving in Vietnam, which is still going on at the same time as this mass shooting. And this is probably why a whole lot of people really covered it, because it's another one of those shadow things, like the bathtub riots of World War One, you know, and Bath Township underneath the behind the shadows of Charles Lindbergh. And oh, he also took a 50 cal round to the leg, and that's why he's back stateside recovering from that. So, you know, those super big rounds that I showed you?
Yeah.
He had also earned the Navy Distinguished Service Medal, Silver Star, Defense Superior Service Medal twice, Legion of Merit, Distinguished Flying Cross 4 times, Bronze Star Medal, and a Purple Heart from his being shot in the leg. The United States Marine Corps and the Coast Guard were in agreement around New Orleans. Whenever the city needed aid to police or fire for high-rise fires, they would come in and assist with their helicopters.
Yeah.
He would call the Coast Guard commander about sending a helicopter to assist with Mark Essex and two Marine Corps sharpshooters with M14 rifles, but after an hour and a half and not seeing the Coast Guard on television, he would find out that the Coast Guard said that the weather was too bad for them to fly. So Pittman would decide on taking it upon himself to temporarily borrow a United States Marine Corps helicopter without authorization, and figured it was easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. Knowing he would be facing a court-martial for taking it without this authorization, he was basically saying, bullshit, this weather is not that bad for me to fly in. I mean, You got shot down 7 times in Vietnam after 1,200 combat missions. I'm sure there's like nothing that can't fucking stop you, because I'm sure he flew in all sorts of weather in that time.
I'm sure.
It's like when I was in the fire service, one of the helicopter pilots was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and we had one other pilot deny a landing zone because of a sign moving around, and he talked to us about it because he had heard about it, and we told him why, and he's like, it's not that fucking tight there. It's like, dude, you're a Vietnam pilot, nothing is. He's like, that's my point exactly. I was like, I put helicopters bigger than this one in smaller spaces. But anyway. So he and his co-pilot and these two Marine sharpshooters would take, you know, the CH-46 C-9, which is kind of like a workhorse helicopter, do everything kind of helicopter for the military.
Mm-hmm.
The visibility was so bad that they couldn't just fly up over the city like you think a helicopter would. So what do you think he does?
Fly low.
On what?
Huh?
He's flying low where?
In the city?
No. He's flying low over the river.
Oh. Why yeah. over the river?
Probably because that's not where the fog's probably more or less dense at that point, because it's where it's all evaporating, would be my guess. I don't know. I couldn't find out why he decided to take this route. Probably because of there's more space than there would be over than trying to mark out his bottom deck. What would be the hard surface, I guess you could say, is probably going to vary from building to building heights, and he just can't see them. But he knows the river is going to be a steady, consistent.
Oh.
You know, the river, the top of the river surface is going to be a consistent thing. So it'd be my guess why he decided to choose this route.
Okay.
I really tried to find more information on why he took his flight path and everything, but. So while him and his crew are flying over the Mississippi River with the bad visibility, he said in interviews that they were actually looking up at the lights of ships that were anchored along the Mississippi River. And Eek. Yeah. And then as they're, you know, following the river, they would fly underneath the highway bridge, and they knew it was the bridge because they could see the lights up above from cars passing over the river. So he's using land nav to get to where he needs to go. So once he finds this interstate bridge, this is where he makes his turn to get to the hotel.
And does he continue to stay low?
Oh, at that point, no. He flies up because now he knows where he's at. And He knows a majority of the topography at this point. That's the word I was trying to find earlier. So he would fly along the river, you know, making this turn at the interstate overpass of the river. And then he would land the helicopter in a parking lot downtown and trying to find the police chief. He would be informed that he would have to walk down Loyola Avenue, which is the road that runs in front of the hotel where the gunfight's going on, to get to the one car in the area with a radio.
Okay.
So yeah, you see how why I'm saying about, I don't know how this man fits balls inside of a helicopter cockpit.
Yeah.
So he's walking down Loyola Avenue. There's like gunfire coming from all directions. He's just walking down this road to get to this car to talk to him. So he finally gets to this police car, radios in the police chief, finding out where the command center is and what he can do to assist. And he finds out it's in the lobby of the hotel, and he's like, you have to be fucking kidding me.
Okay.
So now he finally gets out of this police car, walks across the street, still all this gunfire, and he's in a, you know, his green jumpsuit, probably a huge fucking target at this point, never gets hit once because he casually walked down the street. So his attention, the shooter's attention was never really drawn to him from a running target, from a walking target. So when he goes into the incident command center and starts talking to the police chief first suggests lifting the city's only armored car on top of the roof, but Pittman tell them the car is too heavy because it's about 14,000 pounds and his helicopter has a lifting capacity of like 5,000 pounds. So it's not going to get the amount of lift to lift both objects.
Yeah.
And also it states that it was more than likely it would be too heavy for it to be lifted and safely put on the roof, as it probably just crashed straight through the roof due to its weight.
Damn.
So the plan that they finally do decide on is for Pittman to take police officers up with whatever weapons that they can find and make strafing runs at the helicopter, at the hotel roof.
What's a strafing run?
Basically, like going back and forth.
Zigzagging?
Yep.
Okay.
For the most part. The best way I can put it.
You gotta use stupid terms.
Well, I figure it might be a word you've already known. So over the next several hours, Pittman would make these strafing runs with Marines and officers in the back taking shots at the, you know, the bunker, as I'm calling it, because it's basically what it is. It's reinforced concrete.
Yeah.
You know, more than likely due to withstand hurricane winds, because it's probably one of the tallest buildings in New Orleans at the time. So I'm calling it this bunker just to make it easy to understand where Essex is hiding. They would, you know, take these strafing runs, and then it would have an African-American New Orleans police officer on a loudspeaker trying to convince Mark Essex to give himself up. But he would actually, Mark Essex would actually would emerge periodically, taking shots at the police officers that are on the roof and the helicopter, shouting at them, "Come on and get me."
Damn.
So every time
he gave no fucks.
Yeah. So this, they would make three total strafing runs across the the hotel roof, and they're chipping away at the concrete, but they can't see Mark Essex, but they know he's hiding in there. And they finally figured out what he was doing to get, you know, what's going on. Because one of the officers noticed a metal pipe would move while they're making these strafing runs. So him being 5'4", what he was doing was he was crawling up towards the ceiling, up this standpipe, basically, for the fire, you know, fire suppression. And he was hiding up towards the ceiling. They were probably more likely shooting down where somebody would be either crouched or standing in a corner, where he was hiding up towards the ceiling. Well, once they finally realized this, they would start taking shots at more higher shots, trying to get them to skip across the ceiling to hit him to get him to drop down.
Yeah.
They would eventually end up shattering the water pipe that he was hiding on. So now his hiding spot's compromised. Pittman would also finally notice they have actually figured out where Essex was hiding. And he came up with a plan to basically double back or psych him out, thinking that they were going to go land again to reload all their ammunition.
Yeah.
So when he, on this third and final run that they make, like, Pittman goes, puts his plan into action because he has a giant ass searchlight on the front of it, of this helicopter. So with the searchlight on, so the officers that were shooting could see, what he does is he starts to, you know, psych him out, thinking that they're going to go off and land and reload and everything. But what he does is he actually whips the helicopter around as soon as he comes back out.
Oh.
So what the next thing they do is, and Mark Pittman's, you know, Pittman's plan actually works out perfectly. With their new mags loaded, and now with Mark Essex like acting like a deer stuck in headlights, every surrounding sniper and officer on that helicopter unloads their, you know, firearms into Mark Essex, forcing his body with enough force to force his body up off the ground.
Damn. Did he fall off the building?
No, he did not.
Oh.
Actually, there's a documentary I purchased I thought might be a good resource for other topics later on that actually has footage from this.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Huh.
In the hail of gunfire, basically like in an old spaghetti western, basically Mark Essex is shot, is basically killed on top of this hotel roof, bringing his reign of terror in New Orleans. An autopsy later revealed that his body had over 200 bullet holes in it.
God damn.
Yeah. His carbine rifle would lay in pieces from the gunfire, and they also found that he only had two rounds left in the magazine of his rifle. In 28 hours, Mark Essex would kill 9 people and injure 12. The next morning, that Pittman, knowing he could face a court-martial, he returned to the base, and the Marine Corps was considering court-martialing, but Edward Herbert, New Orleans base representative, which is also the chairman of the U.S. House of Armed Forces Committee, which sees over the Department of Defense, which is where all the military branches are part of, he would tell the Marines to drop the issue. Like, that's all he said. He told the Marine Corps, you drop the issue of him taking that helicopter. So basically, that was his way of saying that's an order.
Huh.
Moon Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, also stated afterwards, without the helicopter and without his piloting skills, it would have been a lot worse. The city owes him a great debt of gratitude. So in the aftermath of Mark Essex's shooting, the police searched his apartment. They found that he had painted over the windows and covered them so no natural light could come in, and the only source of light for his two-room apartment was a single red light bulb. They found a map of New Orleans with a circle drawn around the police HQ and the Howard Johnson Hotel. The walls of the rooms were painted red with black writing of racial and revolutionary slogans in English and Bantu language. Other things he had written were about beasts in African lore. One of the phrases he wrote on the walls was, "My destiny lies in the blood, death of racist pigs."
Okay.
Lou Carbonet, Louisiana State Representative, elaborated, "Here was a boy from Kansas who came here and vented his frustration in a suicide mission. What could I say about him? The black community in New Orleans did not invite him here, nor did we send him up to that rooftop. After the general media," and this is what they said about the whole situation, "after the general media and several other people felt that they wanted the black community of New Orleans to apologize for Mark Essex's actions in January. An unnamed socialist stated Mark Essex's idyllic upbringing in Emporia, Kansas, a community that had prided itself on a long history of racial harmony, had left Mark Essex an ill-prepared to encounter intolerance and continuous racial discrimination as a young adult, as he had never been, quote-unquote, vaccinated against the harsh realities of bigotry as a young child."
Yeah.
Charles Pittman would continue to fly for the United States Marine Corps and retire in 1990 at the rank of lieutenant general.
Is he still alive?
No, he's passed, but I forgot to put that in when he did. 4 decades after her husband's death, Louis Segro's wife, this is the officer that got shot at point blank range in the stairwell, his wife Joyce would annually present the Louis Segro Memorial Award to the most promising recruit of the New Orleans Police Academy that was selected by her or his fellow recruits.
Nice.
So this is another one of those stories. And that's it on Mark Essex. I'm honestly surprised that not more podcasts have ever really covered this.
I've never heard of it.
And like I said in the middle, this could be one of those things that's due to because of Vietnam going on that it's not very well known.
Yeah.
Or in the racial undertones, people might be scared of it, but you'd be impartial about it. You know, it's not our personal thoughts or anything like that.
No.
But it's just one of those things, you know, to show how being a piece of shit, you know, to other people could cause one person to do something extreme like this.
To go crazy a little bit.
Yeah.
I get it.
But yeah, so don't be an asshole to people just because they may or may not look different. We're all the same.
Just don't be an asshole.
And yeah, just don't be an asshole. Yeah, just don't be a cunt in general. Oh, yes, I said that bad, you know, the bad C word.
Word doesn't bother me.
I know it doesn't bother you, but for some people it does. But yeah, just in general, just don't be that, and we all can get along.
Yeah.
Even though with everything that's going on right now, it's the so was that the wild ride that I hyped it up to be for you almost?
I knew the way that you were like excited about it, that it was going to be something along the lines of the stuff that you've already done.
Right.
But I wasn't expecting the whole helicopter.
Yeah, I know.
That was fucking shit.
That's when I was one of the big things why I just chose this. Like, she's never going to expect the outcome, you know, this whole situation to be ended by a whole helicopter being borrowed from the Marine Corps to put an end to this. But I think it's in time we close the Emporium up for the day, Sarah. What do you think?
I agree.
But before we do that, tell us what you think of this on our Facebook group or on the comments section if you listen on Spotify. And we love to see those from you guys.
Yeah.
But anyway, now I think it's time we close the Emporium up for the day, Sarah. What do you think?
I still agree.
All right. So until next time.
Remember to creep it real.
All right. Bye.
Okay, bye. Please go and check out our website at macabreemporiumpodcast.com. Join our Facebook group by searching Macabre Emporium. Like and subscribe on YouTube at Macabre Emporium Podcast. Follow us on TikTok at Macabre Emporium Pod. Follow us on Twitter at Macabre Emporium. If you have any stories of the paranormal, your local true crime, or weird history that you would like us to look into and possibly do an episode on, email us at macabreemporiumpod@gmail.com. And remember to follow, rate, review, and share whenever and wherever you can to help us grow our podcast.